You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 20th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex DeWall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation, Professor at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Policy, on the recent peace treaty signed between Ethiopia and Tigray. Also on the program today, funding bill unveiled with surprise, a big raise for the military. Meanwhile, in that same bill, Republicans killed the cannabis reform legislation. January 6th panel makes its final criminal DOJ referrals. And the Postal Service to go nearly all electric by 2026. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts temporarily halts the Title 42 rollback. Uber drivers wrap up their 24-hour strike over delayed pay raises. And it's day two of Elon Musk's silence on the vote to have him relinquish control of his $44 billion baby. UN strikes a major biodiversity agreement, and people start digging more and more into Republican Congressman-elect Santos out of New York. His story is getting really, really weird. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is a Tuesday.
Newsday, sort of. We have a guest today.
We have a guest, but we'll also be covering some news. One of those stories. We're going to get to this Santos thing. It is really strange.
Yeah.
And there was apparently some... We'll get into it more. But there was apparently some oppo floating around about this guy, but nobody had done quite the digging that needed to be done. In part, it's a function of just like the end of local news and reporting. Because this guy has some very, very strange financial disclosure forms. Mm-hmm. We should all be so lucky to have a two-year span of time where we go from having no money to $11 million in assets, including a couple million in the bank, and not having even worked in one of those years.
Well, you don't have the grind.
No income.
Yeah. Rise and grind.
Yeah, you don't get it. You're not just, you don't have the
You don't have a growth mindset, yeah.
Right.
This guy, I want to say the guy was like involved in something that had like 100x growth, but 100 times zero is still zero.
Mm.
So something happened there, but I'm not sure. I'm awaiting
hey,
report.
Peter Thiel's 0-1.
I'm just awaiting report from Glenn Greenwald, who was the one who introduced all of us to this candidate on Twitter.
Gay.
It was weird, but we'll get.
You just have to manifest more, Sam.
We'll get there. We will dig into this a little bit more in just a bit. But first, yesterday was the final, public. I don't know if it's going to be their final committee meeting at all of the January 6th committee, because as you know, the Republicans will be taking control of the House, and they're not so interested in that and what happened on January 6th and what led up to it. Here is Committee Chair Benny Thompson essentially setting off a montage of some of their major revelations over the past several months. Here's that.
It's important to remember what we've learned and critically exactly what happened at the United States Capitol on January 6th. Without objection, I include in the record a video presentation of some of the key evidence our investigation has uncovered.
There were officers on the ground. They were bleeding. They were throwing up. I mean, I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood.
As I was swarmed by a violent mob, they ripped off my badge. They grabbed and stripped me of my radio. They seized ammunition that was secured to my body. They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects.
The key thing to do is to claim victory. No, we won. Fuck you. Sorry, over. We won. Yeah. You're wrong. Fuck you.
Right out of the box on election night, the president claimed that there was major fraud underway. I mean, this happened, as far as I could tell, before there was actually any potential of looking at evidence.
I didn't think what was happening was necessarily honest or professional at that point in time. So that led to me stepping away.
Generally discussed on that topic was whether the fraud, maladministration, abuse, or irregularities, if aggregated and read most favorably to the campaign, would that be outcome determinative? And I think everyone's assessment in the room, at least amongst the staff, Mark Short, myself, and Greg Jacob, was that it was not sufficient to be outcome determinative.
So, in other words, they all, you know, no one around the president was, well, I shouldn't say that. The president was certainly aware, Trump at the time was aware that he'd lost. And, in repeatedly, the plan was, we're just going to say that we didn't lose. And talk about manifesting.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's also really interesting about this, let's pop up this Beschloss tweet, because this has really been the point from the beginning. I don't think Donald Trump is going to go to jail, folks. There's every indication that the Department of Justice has been slow walking this the whole way through. I guess I can in some way understand it, because they're worried about, you know, tackling something this politically sensitive.
But also powerful people not going to prison for their crimes is as American as apple pie. And crooks like Trump, they let other guys like Manafort take the fall. They have goons on their staff that do this kind of stuff. And I just don't know if he'll actually face consequences.
He won't necessarily. But what's important is that there is a marker put down for the future. And Michael Beschloss, historian, had a tweet yesterday, and I should say hat tip to Duncan Black at Atrios who pointed this out. I saw this on his blog. Beschloss wrote, "Today shows that a mistake was made in pardoning Nixon and sparing him prosecution and possibly jail. Had Nixon had to face more dire consequences than exile, it would have presented an important admonition to later presidents that they could not break the law without suffering." I think you can say this about Watergate. I think you can say this about Iran-Contra. Mm-hmm. I think you can say this about the Keating Seven. I think you can say this about Bush Two in terms of the Iraq War. Over and over again, it is a good that Beschloss is making this point, because this is the point.
And Beschloss is like a very august sort of Sunday news
PBS
show, yeah,
PBS type of style historian. Now, with that said, Beschloss, this is a fairly recent perspective that Beschloss is taking. In 2007, again, Duncan Black, Atrios, pointed this out. 2007, at a JFK library function, the presidential library, He wrote, or he said, I guess, in a conversation with Al Hunt. This was a he was a, you know, like a pundity type of guy years ago. What about Gerald Ford? Gerald Ford pardoning Nixon, I think, was courageous, and in retrospect, wise. This is in 2007. And one of the things I think is actually quite lovely is that Gerald Ford said before he died that one of the things that emotionally meant the most to him was getting the Profile in Courage Award, because it made him feel that despite the fact that he had gone through all that flack and people denouncing him saying, did you make a secret deal with Nixon to get the presidency in exchange for a pardon? He felt that in the end, he had been vindicated. Well. And one thing that's sort of pointed about history is that oftentimes people are not with honor in their time. And the nice thing being with Ford is that he lived to see it. And Alan and I think you were not on the committee, but we were not there then. So, I mean, really, putting aside what it says about Beschloss, who, you know, one of those things about history, I guess, that the longer that we have, the more that we can reinterpret history. This isn't quite one of those situations. This is just, but whether the light has shone on Michael Beschloss sooner or later rather than sooner is almost secondary. The point being that at one point this guy realizes that any holding to account of people in power is important, whether they get punished for it or not. Always better if they get more punished for it, without a doubt. But whether they get punished for it or not is important because it sets down a marker for the behavior that we as a society are willing to accept in the future.
When was that quote? 2007?
Yeah.
That almost aligns perfectly with Nancy Pelosi's cowardice on not going after the Bush administration for their war crimes. And then the shift that you see now, even though, of course, we'd want more of it, but within the Democratic Party, where they actually are attempting to do something, at least with what we saw with Trump.
I don't even think it was a coincidence, too, that Beschloss had said something like that in 07, because they were anticipating the possibility of impeachment hearings that would take place once the Democrats took control of both the Senate and the House and the presidency. In 2008, I don't know exactly when that was there, but that was definitely in the air. And yes, the danger with Donald Trump is as much about the fact that it's only about Donald Trump.
Yes,
that he becomes this sui generis figure in our political history, where George Bush can get whitewashed and his history revised and his turd, as it were, polished, and he can look good in relation to Donald Trump. Just a recollection, as odious as Donald Trump was and is, George Bush was responsible for killing anywhere from 200,000 to a million people. You know, like, you can get with the most conservative, you can go with the U.S. Defense Department numbers, or you can go with, you know, the way that most organizations counted these things. But regardless, hundreds of thousands of people dead because George Bush is, as a function of George Bush, lying to this country. And I will say one more thing, too. I think I was on the boat when Marjorie Taylor Greene made her joke about Steve Bannon, if she and Steve Bannon went in and did January 6th, they would have won. And she came back and said it was a sarcastic joke and people were really offended. George Bush in 2003 or 4, I think it was 2004, got up in front of the correspondence dinner and made an extended joke about where are the weapons of mass destruction. Hundreds of thousands of people died because innocent civilians died because he went after that. And I brought that up on the boat on a panel, and there was someone on the panel, I think it was Cecile Richards, who was there that night. And she said it also had followed someone who had talked about losing a loved one in the war.
He's a monster.
And the media did not hold George Bush to account. Certainly, you know, the Besh losses and whatnot did not hold George Bush to account for that. So,
That's why we cannot treat Trump as an aberration. He has to be treated as an accumulation, because just to bring it back to the Nixon point here, like that, the cowardice of Gerald Ford was called courage by a lot of people. And now that we've stepped away from it, you can see that set the precedent for the moment that we're living in right now. It created presidents like Bush and Trump, and it also allowed them to get away with the stuff that they got away with. And Trump will get away with this.
Yep. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Alex DeWall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation and Professor at Tufts University, a Fletcher School of Law and Policy. And we're going to be talking about Ethiopia and Tigray, the state of the Ethiopia-Tigray conflict. But first, we're going to word from the sponsor.
Jeez.
Yep, this is going to be a hard turn, folks. Sometimes you're going to need a real pro to do a segue like this. Hello, Tushy. Bidets.
As soon as you looked me in the eye, I was like, that's what's happening.
Yep. Well, I mean, let's be honest. You want to be eco-conscious. You want to save toilet paper. You want to, you don't want to go through another situation like we had during the pandemic. And frankly, I mean, just my own personal experience, I can tell you, just a much better lifestyle. Hello Tushy bidets make a great holiday gift. Great one for your eco-conscious cousin, your neat freak sister, your dad, who may spend extended periods of time in the bathroom.
Holy shit.
Bradley is really falling apart over there. My son came on and blew the whistle on me. Hanging out in the toilet for too long. Look, we all deserve a better clean while contributing to a healthier planet. Stop spreading your business around your butt with toilet paper. Start washing with Hello Tushy. The Hello Tushy bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water for a way better clean than toilet paper. You simply spray and pat dry. Look, if you get dirt on your hands, you don't just go look it for a dry, piece of paper towel. Well, you use water. It attaches to your existing toilet. No electrician or plumber needed. You can install it in less than 8 minutes. It really is amazing how easy it is to install. And a small ask for a grand result, and not just for you, but for the whole world. Hello Tushy cuts down on your TP use by 80%. Saves money, saves paper waste. Join the millions of happy Hello Tushy customers right now who take care of their Yule logs in a dignified way. I didn't write that. You should know. Give the, it's actually pretty impressive, but I didn't do it. Give the gift of a clean bum to yourself and your loved ones this holiday season. Get 10% off plus free shipping right now at HelloTushy.com/majority. That's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off and free shipping, and tag at Hello Tushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean butt with you. We've had a lot of listeners who have availed themselves, and they quite enjoy it. Oh, also, what's so funny about that?
Sorry. Just availing themselves. I looked at Matt in the eye, and that was kind of it.
I wanted to do a plug for Joshua Kahn Russell's organization. Folks may remember Joshua. He's been on this program, but he was a regular on Michael's program. And he has an amazing organization that he works for called the Wildfire Project. And essentially, it's time of year where people are making their end of year donations. It is a grassroots movement building organization. Like I say, Josh was on Michael's program often to discuss it. I imagine he's been on your program as well, Matt.
Yeah, check out. There's a classic TMBS clip where Joshua takes us through how to sort of strategize an activist campaign through the Simpsons. If you search Simpsons, Joshua Kahn Russell TMBS, you'll find that.
And what they do with the Wildfire Project is they basically build the infrastructure for movements across all sectors, like racial and economic justice, indigenous sovereignty, LGBTQI movements, labor, all sorts of groups. And Joshua basically functions like a therapist for activists and activist leadership.
Yeah, it turns out there's a lot of like burnout and stress that comes to deal with fighting for this stuff.
And strategies and interpersonal issues and the way that you deal with them and the way that you motivate people. So this is really, I mean, a Wildfire Project is essentially like a tool to help build grassroots organizations. They rely on donations to make their services accessible to low budget organizations on the ground. Michael Brooks was a regular sustaining donor, and he would do pitches on his show regularly. And if you want to help him out, go to wildfireproject.org/donate. We will put a link to that. And we're going to have Joshua on sometime in the beginning of the year because he's a fascinating guy, and the organization does some great work. So check it out. If you're looking for some year-end donations, that's a great place to start. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Alex DeWall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation, professor at the Tufts University Fletcher School for Law and Policy. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. On the phone, we have with us Alex DeWall. He is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation, professor at Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Policy. Professor, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
If you could, I mean, this is a conflict that's been going on for 2 years, at least, I guess, in this form. There was for many, many years a conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. Can you just set the context for us? What changed? You know, what were we talking about when Eritrea and Ethiopia were at war? And what changed from then in terms of leadership? And then maybe walk us up to what ignited the conflict with the Tigray region and Ethiopia, and I guess Eritrea as well, and the Amhara.
So the basic story is this. For about 25 years, from the early 1990s, there were two rival governments in Ethiopia and the former Ethiopian province of Eritrea, which had got independence in 1993. And the Ethiopian government was authoritarian, but relatively open, a very effective developmental state, rapid economic growth, and a sort of an anchor of peace and security in the region. So very popular with Western countries for its stand in fighting terrorism. It was an attractive target for investment. And although it was authoritarian, it wasn't totalitarian. Eritrea, on the other hand, was a totally totalitarian state with no political parties, no judiciary, no budget. published, no constitution, no a one-man show under its president, Isaias Afwerki. That changed in about 4 years ago when a new prime minister was chosen in from within the ruling party in Ethiopia. His name is Abiy Ahmed, and he displaced the group that had been running Ethiopia for the previous 27 or so years, which had its roots in Tigray, the northernmost region of Ethiopia, right next door to Eritrea, and the group that was really disliked, indeed hated, by the Eritrean dictator, Isaias Afwerki. Now, what Abiy did, and it won him the Nobel Prize, was he flew to Eritrea and said, let's make peace, let's normalize relations. Now, what wasn't really properly analyzed, understood internationally at the time, was that peace deal, which was never really made public, was really a security pact between the two leaders, Abiy Ahmed, the young, energetic, supposedly reformist prime minister in Ethiopia, who was doing things like releasing political prisoners and promising radical liberal change, and the old, wily fox of a dictator, Isaias Afwerki. They had decided to gang up and destroy the region of Tigray in the name of eliminating its leadership. So a political dispute among the Ethiopian elite between the former leaders, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, and the incoming ruler, was sort of conjoined with this life and death struggle between the Tigrayans and Eritrea. And 2 years ago, this erupted into outright war.
Professor, may I stop you there and just ask a couple of questions just so that we can take it up to that point? To what extent was the prior leadership that was Tigrayan, the longtime leadership in Ethiopia, what region of the country does Ahmed come from, and what is there are there ethnic differences between the Tigrayans and Ahmed's background?
So historically, if we look back in the history of Ethiopia over the last few centuries, the country has been dominated by a group called the Amhara, and many people will be familiar with Emperor Haile Selassie and his feudal aristocratic rule. And Haile Selassie was an Amhara, and the images we have of Ethiopians with the Orthodox Church and all those symbols of traditional Ethiopian culture are basically the Amhara. Now, the largest group in Ethiopia is not actually the Amhara, but the group immediately to the south, the Oromo, who until Haile Selassie was overthrown in a bloody revolution in 1974, until then, the Oromo were very much second-class citizens. They were serfs. They basically didn't own land. They worked on others' land and so on. And the main ethnic struggle in Ethiopia was between the Amhara and the Ethiopia and the Amhara. I'm sorry, the Amhara and the Oromo. But the Tigrayans gained power after a long war in the 1970s and 1980s and sort of held the ring. Now, in about 6-7 years ago, there was a widespread, largely nonviolent youth uprising among the Oromo, saying, "You know, we've been shut out of power for too long. We want change." And this was what brought down the former ruling coalition and ushered in change. But the leaders of that nonviolent democratic revolution could not assume the prime ministership. They were not represented in parliament, so they opted as an interim choice to have an Oromo leader called Abiy Ahmed, just to hold the ring until elections were held. But Abiy Ahmed had different ideas. He was very ambitious, even megalomaniac, and he immediately started concentrating power in his own hands. And in fact, his first moves were against the Oromo themselves, against that power base that had brought him to office. And he started suppressing them and indeed waging war against them. before embarking on his larger war against the Tigrayans.
And then I want to pick it up from that from the start of the conflict with the Tigrayans, but I can't quite figure out what these wars, like, what are the spoils here? 25 years ago, I had visited Addis Ababa, and I just remember being, I think it was in a cab, and someone explaining to me the conflict between Eritrea and Ethiopia as two bald men fighting over a comb. Like, what are the spoils here? Is this a resource thing? I mean, and what does it mean to have power in the context of Ethiopian or even that regional politics there?
That's a very good question. And the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, which was viciously fought some 25 years ago, was ostensibly a border war, and hence the description of it as bald men fighting over a comb, because the actual disputed border area was barren. It really had no resources at all. But the real conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea, indeed between the Ethiopian leadership, which was Tigrayan at the time, and Eritrea, was over who would be at the top, who would be head of the hierarchy of power in Northeast Africa. And then the conflict within Ethiopia, the dispute between Abiy and the Amhara and the Tigrayans, is, and then increasingly with the Oromos as well, who are broken with Abiy, is really a question of pure power. Who will run this Ethiopian state, which in the last 25, 30 years has become a much more effective and capable state than it was on the previous regimes. It's had a lot of economic growth. So it's really essentially purely a political conflict over who's in power, who runs the show.
Thank you. And so that takes us up to 2 years ago. And this conflict is a function of this deal that I guess Ahmed is – strikes with Eritrea to solidify his power within Ethiopia, and it includes essentially a security pact that is primarily aimed, it seems, at the Tigrayans.
That's correct. It is for Abiy Ahmed. He basically his clear political reasoning is he fears the Tigrayans are still a capable political rival, and he wants to reduce their power. For Isaias Afwerki, it's something more. He sees Tigray really as an existential threat, and he has never hidden his intention, his frankly genocidal intention, of not only defeating the TPLF, but actually crushing the people of Tigray in such a way that they will be set back 30 or more years, reduced to a state of really driven back to the Stone Age. So 2 years ago, they amassed their armies, their respective armies, on the borders of Tigray, and the Tigrayans then struck first, and the narrative that came out at the time was that this was a law enforcement operation by the government in Addis Ababa, that is Abiy Ahmed, in response to the Tigrayan action. But in fact, the Tigrayans struck first in the same sense that the first shots in World War II were fired by the Polish government rather than by the Nazis. It was clearly, there was a military intention of overrunning Tigray, and indeed that is what happened in the first stages of the war. And then the Tigrayans reorganized. They fled. They fled to the mountains. It's a very mountainous area, very hospitable for guerrilla warfare. And they reorganized. They mounted a resistance, and the the main reason why their resistance was so successful was the level of atrocities and destruction inflicted on the Tigrayan people by the combined forces of the federal government under Abiy Ahmed and the Eritreans under Isaias Afwerki, so antagonized, so alienated the ordinary people of Tigray that they flocked to take up weapons and resist the occupier.
And his fear of the Tigrayans, that's based on their sheer numbers, right? And also, I mean, what is it as well as that? Is their level of political organization against him formidable in and of itself as well?
Well, the Tigrayans actually are a relatively small minority. So Ethiopia as a whole is about 120 million. And the Tigrayans are about between 5 and 6 million. So they're relatively small. And in fact, one of the points that alarmed many international diplomats was that Abiy Ahmed candidly said to them, he said this to the U.S. Special Envoy, the European Special Envoy, who cares about these 5 million people? Ethiopia is much bigger. We have more than 100 million people. Abiy, I think, was afraid of was that the Tigrayans do have this reputation of being very well organized and being very formidable fighters. And that is, in fact, what they proved during the 2 years of war. They were able to repeatedly defeat much, much larger armies sent to them, against them by the federal government in Ethiopia, the regional state of Amhara next door, which is much, much bigger than Tigray, and the Eritreans, who are about the same size as Tigray, 5 million, but also very well organized with a huge army. So the Tigrayans showed their battlefield prowess, and during the first year of war, not only drove out the occupying forces out of Tigray, but at one point about a year ago, actually marched to within 150 miles or so of the capital, Addis Ababa.
And so at one point the Ethiopian government and I guess Eritrea decided that the way to defeat the TDF was to essentially starve the people of Tigray.
That's absolutely correct. The key weapon, and sadly the most effective weapon they had, was starvation. And this war of starvation unfolded in two phases. The first was when they were actually in occupation of Tigray, which was from about the end of November of 2020 for about 8 months. And that was a period of pillaging and looting, stealing food, destroying businesses, closing the banks, stealing the money, destroying the health infrastructure, the water infrastructure, raping tens if not hundreds of thousands of women and girls and so on. So destroying everything that was there to sustain life, to sustain livelihoods and development, driving people off their land, etc. And then when the Tigrayans resumed, had drove out the occupiers and controlled Tigray, they were completely surrounded. And what the Ethiopian and Eritrean forces did was they enforced a blockade, which meant almost no humanitarian aid went in. And all banking services, telecommunications, trade, etc., was completely shut off. So all those people who had their life savings in banks, in insurance schemes, and so on, couldn't get hold of any money. No one could be paid. Business ground to a halt, and then virtually no aid was allowed in. And then when the war resumed in August of this year, and the advancing armies of Ethiopia and Eritrea overran quite significant areas of Tigray again, more than 1 million people were displaced, and they simply had absolutely nowhere to go, no shelter, no food, no medicine, and it really looked as though hundreds of thousands would die. In fact, the death toll from famine during the last 2 years is estimated at about 600,000. That's about 1 in 10 Tigrayans perished of hunger and disease during this period. It's a terrible toll.
So where has the UN been during this time? Where has the United States been during this time? I don't know other players. I know that China at one point had invested heavily in Ethiopia. I don't know if that has continued. But where is the rest of the world while this is happening?
Pretty much looking the other way is the answer to that. Normally one would expect the African Union to take a lead in addressing conflicts in Africa. In this case, the African Union headquarters is in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, and has always been somewhat under the thumb of the Ethiopian government. So right at the beginning, when African leaders began to mobilize, they sent a delegation of three former heads of state to Addis Ababa to press for peace. And they were rebuffed, and the African Union actually then said, no, we'll handle this as a domestic matter. We won't invoke our peace and security mechanisms to respond to this. And what should then have happened is the UN Security Council should have taken it up. But the Ethiopians found they had strong allies in China and Russia, and which threatened vetoes, and the Western nations, which were initially very concerned, weren't able to override that. When President Biden took office, he appointed a special envoy and began in his first months in office making some very strong statements, saying that the level of ethnic cleansing, of mass rape, of starvation was completely unacceptable. But he got very little diplomatic traction. And there wasn't much popular outrage, partly because the very, very little press coverage. And so the conscience of ordinary people has not really been stirred around this. And after a while, the U.S. policy has been very much, let's stick with the devil we know, that is Abiy Ahmed, rather than trying to engineer some form of power sharing or change in government. They just didn't want to go down that road. And so the U.S. has been pretty weak and pretty slow in pushing for peace negotiations and for humanitarian access to save the starving.
Well, we have been asked to cover this for months and months, and to some extent, we don't have the resources to be doing, on the ground reporting, and no one here has a particular expertise in that area. And it has really taken a long time for us to get just even a handle on who we should bring on to talk about it, because we have no sort of mechanism to even assess what people coming on, and it does feel like there is a tremendous amount of information warfare, if you will, for lack of a better term, coming out of this conflict to obscure the basis of the conflict and what's actually happening on the ground. There feels like there has been a failure across multiple mechanisms, including the UN and including journalism, in addressing this, with 600,000 people die in a matter of what effectively is months. Give me your sense of that.
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, it's remarkable that the last international journalist who was able to travel into Tigray was Declan Walsh of the New York Times, who went in June of last year. So that is 18 months ago. There hasn't been a single international journalist permitted in since then. And that information blockade, blackout, seems unfortunately to work. It means that there is very little reporting. And we would expect that humanitarian workers, of whom a certain number, a small number, were allowed in, in normal circumstances, would also be reporting. They'd be gathering data, but they've not been allowed to speak out. Any aid worker who comes out of Tigray and comes out with pictures or with data is told, if you make these available, your organization will be expelled from the country. And 14 months ago, the Ethiopians expelled a number of very senior UN aid workers for precisely this reason, and it got the others to shut up very effectively. And you add on to this a very aggressive social media campaign, so that people like me who've spoken out about it, we are deluged with really hateful social media messages and campaigns, with my university being deluged with demands that I be fired and so on. And most of the people who would normally be writing columns about this and so on, you have to have a very thick skin to continue writing when you know you will be relentlessly attacked and defamed in this way. But one thing that we're just beginning to see now, because the conflict isn't just in Tigray, it's in other parts of Ethiopia too. And the same people who purvey these very hateful, violence-inciting social media messages have got such a sense of impunity that they're losing a sense of proportion and restraint. So that over the last week, from the south of the country, from the Oromo area where the conflict is also ongoing, they've been circulating videos of the militiamen parading around villages with severed heads on sticks, and videos of people being burned alive or even skinned alive, the sort of medieval barbarism that you wouldn't expect to see in the 21st century. And I think that is beginning to wake up a wider constituency to just how horrible this war is and how gross the atrocities that are being perpetrated are.
What's your sense of where this disinformation campaign, we know the source of the media blackout, right? It's a crackdown. But in terms of who might be organizing it online to suppress it from getting to a international audience, can you speculate on that?
You don't need to speculate. It's very clear that there are certain diaspora Ethiopian groups that are organizing this, and they are encouraged and on occasions organized and financed by the Ethiopian government, by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. About a year ago, he actually dismissed most of his ambassadors because he said they weren't doing a good enough job. And he said, well, our Twitter lions are doing a far better job, and these are the people who should be giving the resources for advocating on our behalf.
Several weeks ago, there was two separate, treaties signed. The first was in Pretoria, South Africa. The second in Nairobi. The first, if my understanding is correct, was a cessation of hostilities. And the second was essentially a way of making that permanent in a deal, political concessions by the Tigrayans in exchange for ostensibly for aid to come in and keep people from dying of starvation. Give us your assessment of both those agreements and what has taken place in the wake of the signing of those agreements.
Well, the immediate background to this is that at the end of August, there was this enormous new offensive was mounted by the combined armies of Ethiopia and Eritrea with many, many militia as well. And the Tigrayans, who were in defensive positions, were inflicting enormous casualties. And they assumed that the level of casualties that they were inflicting, especially on the non-commissioned officers and the junior officers, was such that the Ethiopians would give up after a few weeks. Didn't happen. 70 days of non-stop fighting and attacks. And the level of fatalities is quite extraordinary. The Ethiopian chief of staff himself admitted that his army, his regular army, had lost 136,000 dead in those 10 weeks of fighting. And the fatalities among the militia are probably higher. The fatalities among the Eritreans probably almost as high. So that is a level of death and destruction actually at the battlefront that I don't think we've seen since World War II. And I mean, just dwell on those figures. I mean, probably 350,000 dead on one side in a matter of weeks. It's quite horrifying. And what the Tigrayans basically discovered, they were suffering too, but much lower numbers because they were in defensive positions, was that the Prime Minister Abiy and President Isaias were ready to continue losing hundreds of thousands of young people at the front in order to prevail in this war. And the arithmetic just didn't add up for the defenders. They just had to recognize either they would be completely wiped out or they would have to sue for peace. So at the first opportunity, in fact, the only opportunity, which was the African Union summoned them for peace talks, on the assumption, actually, the African Union assumed that they would have surrendered by then. They would have been defeated. But as it happened, they weren't defeated. But they went and they said, okay, we will sue for peace. We will accept very adverse political terms in order to stop the fighting, in order to just stop this extraordinary level of destruction and loss of life. And so that agreement was signed in Pretoria on November the 2nd after 8 days of talks. It's not a good agreement. It's a hastily patched together agreement. And essentially it is, as you say, a deal in which the Tigrayans concede their main political demands. They will dismantle their political party and their regional government in return for getting aid and having a ceasefire. And then the details of the ceasefire were then worked out in a subsequent round of negotiations in Nairobi the following week. And the basic deal there is that the Tigrayans will disarm, but only when the Eritreans have withdrawn. Now, what we have seen over the month or so since the signing of these two agreements is not much. There is certainly the fighting has stopped, and that's good. Some aid has come in. Some services have been restored. That's good. But banks aren't functioning. Telephone isn't functioning. Hospitals really are still not running. And the Eritreans are still there. And they're still actually killing and looting. And meanwhile, in other parts of Ethiopia, especially in Oromia, the war is intensifying. So the forces that were fighting in Tigray have been relocated to a new front. The drones that were flying over Tigray and on a daily basis 2 months ago are now attacking sites in other parts of Ethiopia. So if a cessation of fighting in Tigray just means an intensification of fighting elsewhere in Ethiopia, this is not good news.
How does a regime, I'm talking about the Eritrean and the Ethiopian Ahmed regime, how does it sustain losses like that? Tens of thousands of domestically, is there no pressure? I guess it's a two-parter. A, is there no pressure domestically? I mean, I guess if you're living in a totalitarian state, there isn't necessarily a huge opportunity for it. And there's no reason to believe that there's necessarily any better information traveling domestically than there is internationally, I guess, at this point. But also, I would add, as a second part of that question, if Ahmed starts to attack the Orama, is there not opportunity for some type of like united front from the Tigrayans, or they basically just need to, make sure that they don't have continued widespread starvation?
So those are two very good questions, and actually every time I speak to an Ethiopian, I ask the first question. I say, what are people in Ethiopia saying about this level of losses? How is it that it is still possible, after losing, several hundred thousand young men and young women at the front line, that still there are tens of thousands of young people being trained and sent into this meat grinder? And the answer I get is, they don't know what's going on. The information control is so complete that these young people who go to training camps think that they are just going to go for a walkover, or they're going to do peacekeeping or policing duties in areas where normality has returned. And there are stories of there was one story I was hearing, a young woman who was captured by the Tigrayans, and she hadn't even understood that she was actually in a battle. Her whole force had surrendered without really firing a shot because they didn't know how to use their weapons. And she was just asking for her cell phone. She said, "Oh, I've lost my cell phone. Who are you? Where? What's going on? How can I call my mother?" And we hear about Vladimir Putin, recruiting these people and sending them into Ukraine and just telling them it'll be a walk in the park. And I think something similar has been happening in Ethiopia.
Well,
but Abby, in response to your second
question. Well, let me just, I'm sorry, forgive okay. me, but let me just, because, like I say, I was there 25 years ago, and I don't know that I had ever seen that level of poverty, frankly. I'm not that well traveled, but I had traveled a little bit up to that point. And is there widespread use of cell phones? Is there any type of like social media there? I mean, just, how is that type of, to lose hundreds of thousands of people, right, who are presumably your neighbors. I mean, there's, 100 million people. It's a big country. You would need a tremendous amount of control, or a complete absence of any type of like mechanism in which for people to talk.
It is quite extraordinary that it has been maintained like this for so long. And indeed, in quite a lot of areas where there have been where communities have lost a lot, there is definitely a demand for this has to end. But it is also quite bizarre, and I don't really have a proper explanation for it, I have to say, for why it is possible for so many people to be willingly mobilized, because some of them are forced, there's no question, but many of them are just willingly join the army. And perhaps it is simply because so many of them so poor, there's so little employment. The economy, which was until very recently growing very fast, it was one of the fastest growing economies in the world. Now it's one of the fastest contracting economies. So young people are desperate for any sort of employment. But surely, for sure, there's going to be to be a huge backlash and price to pay and a social trauma arising from this.
Is it fair to kind of say that because of that kind of contraction in the economy, that the more nationalist rhetoric is more appealing?
I think the nationalist rhetoric actually was... it began when the economy was still expanding fast, and it was I think part of the problem was that the economy was visibly expanding, and these beautiful buildings were being built in the major cities, but there were still a lot of young people who felt, we're not part of this, we're not actually getting the jobs that we want. And now and then as it turns into a downward spiral with people being unable to afford the basics because of rampant inflation and factories closing and thousands of people being displaced from their farms and so on, then the search for culprits, for scapegoats, then becomes very intense.
And so the second part of my question, with basically forging a somewhat unstable or peace with Tigray, and then essentially turning their weapons on the Oromo, is there not an opportunity for some type of Tigrayan Oromo, popular front, or what does that mean for? Going forward,
this was certainly being very much talked about a year ago, when the Tigrayans were militarily on the offensive. But Prime Minister Abiy is a master of divide and rule. I mean, he may not have the skills of a nation builder or for managing the economy, etc., but he is very, very good at the sort of tactical day-to-day or week-to-week manipulation of politics. And he has so far, sort of managed this very skillfully, this dance among these different groups that could, if they combined, would certainly be able to force him from power. But he's used the resources he has, including he's had a fair amount of cash in hand from Middle Eastern backers like the United Arab Emirates, from Turkey. From the sale of key economic assets like the telecom system, he's used the resources he has to sort of to bribe and pay off whole segments of the political elite, and meanwhile going to and intimidating others. So even the Oromo, who are the ones who are currently suffering mostly in the war, are very divided. So it is partly a war of Amhara forces against Oromo forces, but it's also Oromo versus Oromo. There is an internal conflict going on there. And Abiy is very capably turning these communities against each other, which is dreadful but effective.
Well, Alex DeWall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation and Professor at Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Policy, I really appreciate your walking us through this conflict, and perhaps we can catch up with you again sometime in 2023 to get a sense of how this has developed, and maybe we'll have more questions for you then. But this has been a really, really educational for me personally, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I hope I'll have some more optimistic answers to give next time we speak.
Yes, indeed. Thanks again.
Thanks, Alex.
Alex DeWall. We will put a link to some of what you've written over the past couple months on this conflict. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, then we're going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Well, I think we have we closed the door on the best ofs?
We have.
If you wanted to vote for one, we'll take a look if people voted overnight. But what's that? I guess if you get it in the next hour or two, I mean, but we're going to make a couple of decisions today, and then we're going to round out the rest of it in the next couple of days. It has been the tradition of this program for the past 12 years that, you know, during from like around Christmas through the new year, we run some best ofs, usually five or six episodes. I think there's been one or two times where we've done like seven or eight because of the way that New Year's and Christmas fell. This year we didn't get that lucky. So check those out. Also, just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. Become a member. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. And you get some bennies from the app, Majority app.
Ooh.
Sign
me up.
I've never heard of the term bennies, and I've never heard of benzos being called bennies. So what are bennies that you're referring to?
Well, I'm saying benefits.
Oh.
Like, as in, like, you get a job and you benzos. Get full bennies. And then Matt was taking that to mean benzos.
Yes.
Which is also a term that back in the day you would refer to benzos as bennies. And so there you get that. Somebody's saying, for Christmas, I want a new Android MR app. It's coming. It's coming. It is coming. I guarantee it. And members get to IM the show, and you can hear that. And then, you know, the last question is like Dan from Columbus. Wait, is there a place to vote for best of, or did I misunderstand? I sort of misspoke. You get an opportunity to nominate a show, and then we vote.
Then it goes into a black box.
And then it goes into a black box, and we vote. We vote, and that's the way it...
it's an Elon Musk poll.
Indeed. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And here's a little secret. Starting tomorrow, there's going to be a big sale from our pals over at Sunset Lake Sabaday.
Ooh.
So stay tuned for that info. We got a big cache of Sabaday came into the office. Fudge. Everybody was like, oh, God. Because that is a real problem.
You need to figure out a way to like disperse sweets more equally throughout the year,
yes,
as opposed to like all in December.
All I know is the way I disperse it is I just yell at everybody in the office, take it out, take it out of the office.
Yeah, I took all the cookies home yesterday.
I had like six cookies before they left the office though, in like 5 minutes.
Should I give these to someone and pass it off as me making it, or would that be?
That you made CBD?
No. Brandon's cookies, because I can't have these around me anymore. This is getting to be, I'm becoming like you. This is becoming a problem.
Yep. Yeah. That's a real problem.
Wow.
Also, don't forget wildfireproject.org. We will put a link to that in our in the podcast and YouTube description. Emma! God, I'm still basking in that World Cup.
And you're ignoring the Patriots?
I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, well, it was pretty, pretty, pretty awful.
The World Cup was great. And really, in many respects, they're New England's team.
Yes, right. I think, Argentina.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, well, it
was... Massachusetts is the Argentina of North America.
I mean, in many respects. I feel like...
You can make it work. We did talk about the World Cup. I also kind of, like, as being a bit of a soccer noob, ranted about the usage of penalty kicks in a single elimination setting. I feel like that might not be the best choice to determine who's the real winner of the game. Because in hockey, in the playoffs, they suspend shootouts. And that's not single elimination. It's best of seven series.
I feel like maybe I'm wrong about this, but I feel like the shootouts thing in soccer were sort of like casual fans like us are to blame because I feel like they did that to appeal to us.
So they did the same thing with hockey, which was that, you know, like if it was a tie, you know, whatever. I don't want to get into a whole thing about it, but it's meant to get people into it because everyone can understand, like, oh, you win this competition, you get the puck in, you get the goal, whatever. So I don't really think that's the best outcome, but it was still very exciting. And then we also spoke about an insane week in the NFL, the Patriots collapse, Vikings making history by coming back from the largest deficit ever, supplanting Frank Reich when he was with the Buffalo Bills versus the Houston Oilers in the 90s. Poetic in and of itself, and some other NFL discussion, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Matt, it's happening in the Matt Leck Media. And
Matt Leck Media, we are talking.
It seems too, like, I feel like I need a third, fourth thing.
Nope, it's in Matt Leck Media. We're talking about how free speech and workplace safety are sexy with adult film stars Xander Corvus and Summer Hart tonight. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We talked for like over an hour, so I think some of the interview might be cut and saved for patrons. So Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get access to that and the post game.
See you in a fun half. 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are black.
guys are blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.